Good afternoon, everybody.
My name is John Adams. I am an attorney at the Chicago-based litigation boutique Eimer Stahl, and I'm also president of the Chicago Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society. Before we begin today's programming, just a few housekeeping notes. For all attendees seeking CLE credit, you are required to sign in each day to receive credit. If you have not already done so, use the QR code on the CLE card provided by Nick Marr, who's walking around and should have placed some CLE cards on your table. If you don't have that card, there are also volunteers on the outside of the room, and there's also a placard outside the room where you can scan and get CLE credit. And per DC regulations, please wear a mask unless you are eating or drinking. Today's panel, A View from In-House, is the latest event in a series of significant discussions hosted by the Federalist Society's In-House Counsel Working Group about corporate America and practicing law in corporate America. Earlier this year in February, for example, we hosted a forum on law and corporate social responsibility. Just a few months ago, in September, right here at the Mayflower, we hosted a debate on the duties and the responsibilities of the corporation as it relates to its shareholders versus its stakeholders. We will continue the same great programming next year. In May, I am pleased to announce that the Federalist Society will host its first ever in-house counsel symposium in Chicago with two major panels on cybersecurity and federalism in corporate law, along with various breakout sessions hosted by our sponsors, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Our Chicago May in-house counsel symposium will also be privileged to hear keynote remarks from General Bill Barr, who at one point in his illustrious career, as we all know, served as general counsel to a leading American company, much like the panelists on this star-studded panel. Now, for today's in-house discussion, to moderate today's in-house discussion, is the Honorable Britt Grant, who serves as a judge on the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. Judge Grant, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us.
Let's make sure my microphone is working. Thank you very much. It's my honor and pleasure to be here. It's great to see a very full house. I'm sure many of you are in-house lawyers. Many of you might like to be an in-house lawyer. So I'm really pleased to be here and have the honor to introduce all of these great panelists. First is Mary Beth Buchanan. She's the President Americas and Global Chief Legal Officer at Merkle Science, a predictive crypto risk and intelligence platform. Next is Katie Biber. She is the Chief Legal Officer at Brex, a $7.5 billion fintech startup. Next in line is Carrie Ryerson. She's the General Counsel at Shamrock Foods Company, a $4 billion privately held food distributor and supplier. And last but certainly not least is Jenny Kim, the VP of Operations and the General Counsel at the Philanthropy Roundtable, whose vision is to build and sustain a vibrant American philanthropic movement that strengthens our free society. So thank you very much to our guests. We look forward to an engaging panel. I'll pose the first question to Mary Beth Buchanan. You served in government and private practice, like many of your colleagues on this panel. What was it that brought you into the in-house world?
Great question. I think throughout my career, and probably a lot of us, there are so many things we want to be. And so we keep trying everyone until we find the right one that fits. For me, after leaving the government, I did a brief stint with the United Nations, and then I became a partner with an international law firm. And there I was working with a lot of the same types of cases and issues that I had handled when I was an assistant U.S. attorney and U.S. attorney, so basically representing the same kinds of people that I used to prosecute. Then, in 2013, I encouraged our law firm to create a digital currency team because cryptocurrency was becoming a thing, you know, at that time, and people were talking about it, and the industry was developing. And so, they agreed, and they thought it was a good idea to create a cross-disciplinary team to be able to handle all the issues that those in the cryptocurrency space, would be facing. And I started going to conferences, meeting people, and then all of a sudden I started getting clients. And so I was representing coin developers and exchanges and funds. And one of those clients had a serious bet the company issue. And they were almost put out of business by a federal regulator. And by the time they came to me, it was so dire. They were on the verge, literally being forced to sign a consent decree. And so I spent about a year going to the Agriculture Committee, working within the particular agency. And finally, after about a year, we were able to back them down. But I realized this is a significant issue that this company found themselves facing. And had they had better counsel, you know, from the beginning, they could have done things a lot differently. They could have structured their product differently. They could have made some changes to have avoided all of this happening. And they also wouldn't have totally antagonized the agency before they came to me. So I realized that this new cryptocurrency space is one that could really benefit from someone who had spent a lot of time in the government, as I had, and who knows how to talk with regulators and with the Department of Justice when these issues come up. And this new space with the regulatory uncertainty, a company could really benefit. So one of my clients, not that one, but another one, did ask me to come in-house as their general counsel. And so it was, a decision I made to do one of the things that I wanted to do during my career, which is be general counsel, and to try to help them from the ground up and try to get them in a position where they're going to be able to navigate this regulatory uncertainty.
That's great. Thank you. Katie, what about you? Your background was in election law and campaign work, so that's a different path. Tell us what brought you to the in-house world.
My first in-house job was for a law firm client, actually, the Romney for President campaign. It's a very non-traditional in-house job. You don't really think of presidential campaigns as being in-house legal roles. But, you know, in essence, a large presidential campaign will raise and spend over $1 billion and scale from a 2 or 3-person entity to a multi-thousand person entity relatively quickly, just like a Silicon Valley startup, which is why after the 2012 Romney campaign, I fell pretty easily into practicing in-house tech law. I started out in the consumer space in San Francisco and then pretty quickly moved into fintech and crypto and financial services, where there's a lot of really interesting activity happening right now. Being in-house just sort of suits my personality. I like the context shifting of it, going from esoteric, interesting appellate-level legal issues all the way down to mundane, tactical problem-solving. And it's something that I would recommend to anybody who's interested in that sort of back and forth shifting throughout the day.
That's great, thank you. Carrie, what about you?
So actually Shamrock found me. I was in private practice, totally content. I was going to trial 6 weeks later when outside recruiter from Shamrock called. I declined to go meet with them. And they said, no, we really want, just give us an hour. So I gave them an hour, and then 2 days later, I had an offer. So I started as Shamrock's in-house employment attorney, and Shamrock is privately held. We're in the third generation, soon to take over the fourth generation, and they're 100 years old. They've never had a legal department. They've never had a general counsel until me. So when I started, there was me, and I reported to the CHRO, and there was another contract lawyer, but she wasn't really a general counsel. She just sort of handled contracts. So within a couple of years, I became the general counsel. I convinced them that they needed a legal department, a legal function, and so now I manage all of their risk, safety, and legal processes. And the thing that I really enjoy about working for a privately held company in particular is I'm there to facilitate what they want, right? My job is to grease the skids. My job is to move as fast as they do, and I think that one of the best things that you can do as an in-house attorney is build really good partnerships with your outside attorneys to enable you to respond almost instantaneously when the company wants to pivot. Never can anybody say at Shamrock that they're waiting on legal, and if they do, they know that they're lying. So, it's a good fit culturally, and they play a lot of golf, which I love. So.
If any business leaders are watching this, you might get some calls to try to steal you away from their company if you focus on making whatever the business leaders want to happen. Jenny, what about you? You've got a different role. Tell us about your transition.
Yeah, so I was with Koch Industries until recently for about 13 years. And in 2008, originally probably Jack Abramoff and the Honest Leadership and Open Government Act brought me to Koch Industries because I was put into charge of putting together a political law compliance program so ranging from lobbying reports, campaign finance, et cetera. I chose to go in-house from Miller and Chevalier to there because I didn't just want to recite the law all day long and learn how to write great briefs. I also wanted to understand how accounting, HR, and the legal functions all work together and kind of build something from scratch. And so for 13 years, I worked there and moved at the pace of light and whatever else needs to be structured, and also worked on some public policy issues like tort reform and criminal justice reform as well, which then led me to where I am right now at the Philanthropy Roundtable. And I came here again because I wanted to help build the systems that ultimately will cost savings, but also advance the mission and also kind of integrate the operations with the legal. Because I think so often what ends up happening is, and especially with outside counsel, they give you the law, but you're just like, what am I supposed to do with this, right? How can I actually integrate it? And sometimes some things may not be actually integratable, in which case it's time to go back to the drawing board, probably back up to the legislature or the executive branch and try to figure out how to change it. And I think that's the beauty of in-house. No day is the same, and you get to interact and think about a broad range of things.
Thank you. Let's start with you this time, Carrie. Since you were in charge of really building an internal practice, an internal law firm at your company, how do you go about looking for in-house counsel to be a part of your organization? And what do you think is important for people to think about who might be interested in moving into that role?
So when I looked at trying to set up a new legal department, obviously you have to put the right processes in place, right? Before you can have people to run the processes, you got to set it up, make sure that it works well for the business unit so that you can be appropriately responsive as quick as they want the response. And then actually when I had to hire my first attorney, I called somebody I knew and trusted, right? I didn't want to hire somebody completely off the street. I wanted to hire somebody who I knew would have my back and we can operate, you know, as a team. And then even when I hired the second attorney, now there's three of us, it was the same calculus. Who can I trust? Who I know will do good work and will ultimately have the best interest of the business at heart and not themselves when they're making decisions and giving legal advice. And I wanted people who were egoless. Because when you're, Jenny and I were just talking, when you're in a law firm, you're the profit center. Mm-hmm. You're very important in a law firm, right? People cater to you, you have secretaries that run and paralegals that jump. That's not how it is when you're the cost center in-house. And you have to realize that, and you have to set your ego aside, and you have to appreciate that you're there to serve the C-suite and the rest of the business. So you can't have a lawyer who can't get past themselves and let somebody else run the ship. You're not in charge of the business, you're simply there to advise. And so I always look for that with attorneys or even outside counsel that I partner with.
Katie, what about you? What's your perspective on that?
So I really like what Carrie said because I find it to be true in my day-to-day hiring as well. There's nothing more true than to not be the most important person in the room and in the in-house context. If you're at a law firm, you know, people hang on to your every word. You're billing $1,600 an hour or more for your services, and nobody views you that way inside of a corporation. Your value comes from your ability to solve practical problems and help launch actual product out the door. So what I look for when I'm hiring, I think first and foremost, is just raw horsepower. I've been told sometimes that I frighten people in interviews, which is not what I intend to do, but testing people's mettle is a really important part of what I do when I'm talking to an interviewee. Second of all, I look for somebody who's got a particular subject expertise that is critical to the company's growth. And as far as my company is concerned, that's several different areas of financial services law. So looking for somebody who actually has a deep understanding of the alphabet soup of financial regulation. And then third, I look for somebody who's really able to absorb business goals. We have a series of norms on my team that we talk about a lot, and one of them is be a builder, not an arsonist. And a lot of in-house lawyers are frankly arsonists, and you can't survive inside of an in-house startup context very long by just blowing up good ideas and not helping make them better. More to the point, one of the things that I frequently tell my team is, you know, when you're going through somebody's document and you're trying to provide feedback about an idea that they have, don't merely leave annoying comment bubbles off to the side. This issue may be controversial. This could be risky. The regulators might not like this. I always tell them, never comment where you can redline. Fix the problem. Don't just comment on the problem. And that goes back to what I see the in-house lawyer's role is. We're there to steward product to market, to defend the company when the regulators disagree with what we're doing, and to make sure that we avoid problems in the first place.
Makes a lot of sense. What about you, Mary Beth?
Sure. Well, I agree with everything that's been said so far, and I take a slightly different approach, I guess, in having built the two different legal teams that I've built this far. It's something that kind of comes together, because you have to figure out who do you have on your team, what are their strengths, and not to hire someone who is, you know, a one-trick pony. You want to try to get someone who has a couple of different skills and then figure out how you can cover, you know, all the ground that you need to cover with the team that you have, and then to know when you need to ask for additional resources to be able to broaden the team. And I particularly like one of Katie's comments about, you know, being the job is to understand the business objectives and to figure out how to get the company to where they want to be when you can. But if what they want to do is so risky that it's going to get them into trouble, what the in-house counsel and team needs to be able to do is to point out those risks and to be able to accurately assess the seriousness of those risks. And if what the company wants to do truly is so risky, you need to have the ability, the confidence to tell them that. And I don't want anyone on a legal team who tells me what they think I want to hear. I want the team to tell me, you know, the way it really is. Give me the information and let's best arm the company so that they can make the decisions that need to be made.
I'm sure that's especially challenging in a new area like the crypto space where everything is taking shape. How do you work through managing and evaluating those risks?
It's pretty hard sometimes, particularly because all of these crypto companies want to be global and they want to operate everywhere in the world, which is fine, but it's not one big world. There's separate countries out there, and you know, you need to comply with the laws in every country in which you're doing business. That means all the laws, you know? And so we have used a lot of different, you know, mechanisms to try to comply with all of those laws. But sometimes it is a point at which, for me, there is a business decision all the way up to a certain line. And then after you cross that line, it's either a crime or it's not. Mm-hmm. So for me, that is where I kind of draw the line.
It's a key line.
I will say, look, I, you know, all these other decisions that you want to make, I tell you what the risk is. I tell you what you know, the law is in these countries. And you can decide, like, how much risk you want to take. But at this point, this is signing up to go to jail. And this is a crime. And I cannot participate in this. So that, you know, you can't say that every day, or hopefully you're not in a company where you have to say that every day. But when you need to say it, you have to have the, you know, the conviction and the strength to say it.
Well, and it's important to note, you won't even have the opportunity to say no unless you've built up that credibility as a true business partner, as somebody who actually understands what's going on and what the company's goals are. If all you do is do the Dr. No thing, you will be unemployed relatively quickly. You have to really understand what the company's trying to accomplish.
And I think you also have to understand, like, what your client, because sometimes you may use the same words but mean totally different things, and you really have to understand and dig deep. And I think sometimes there are internal clients who don't know how to ask the right questions, even of lawyers. So their immediate, like, question that they ask you, like, can I do this? You're like, no. And they're like, okay, and they go away, and you know they're not going to just accept that no and go off and do something bad. So you actually have to say, no, come back here. I need you to understand what alternatives are you thinking about. And I say this because, like, I did have to deal with a lot of situations where, you know, you want to sponsor a lot of things, but then there are a lot of government officials there. You have to be careful about what you hand out, how much it could be handed out. You know, we have 50 states in the United States, and then the world is, you know, very large. So you have to, they will take the no, and then they'll go off and do their own thing. And you have to make sure that they understand, this is no, but what about this? What about this? Actually learn how to engage with the lawyer to be the business partner that all of the other panelists have indicated.
Yeah, and no client brings a perfectly formed question to you, like law school style. It's much like the sort of, you know, a patient who might go to a doctor having Googled his symptoms, and he comes in and says, doctor, do I have cancer or not? A good doctor doesn't say, well, no, you don't have cancer. A good doctor says, tell me about your symptoms, and let's talk about what problem you want to solve. And that's what you frequently have to do in the in-house context as well. Nobody actually knows how to ask for the legal advice they're looking for, so you have to learn how to ask questions and understand their goals.
Well, and I think one of our biggest roles is telling them, this is an orange jumpsuit question, this is not an orange jumpsuit question, right? Like, that's sort of what, kind of the line that Mary Beth was talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a funny example. One of the companies, and I won't say which one that I worked with, the leadership didn't understand that producing documents in a federal case is not optional. And you know, we were in this case in front of a pretty stern judge, and he said, "Well, what? Show me the case law. Where's the law? Where does it say it?" I'm like, "It's not written anywhere." But trust me, we have to turn this over. But what I was able to do was to explain to him all of the ramifications that he would face if we didn't turn over documents in this case. And I think after making it pretty personal, he got it after that.
That is the job of a good counsel. So along the lines of what you're talking about, having to draw those lines and having to make sure that your clients understand where those lines are, have you ever had to let outside counsel go? And how do you navigate that process?
Oh, yes. I've terminated relationships with outside counsel before.
That's a very clean, sterile way of putting it.
Look, there are times when a relationship just doesn't work. And for me, it usually boils down to one of a few different factors. I think, first of all, the bills. When you sign a bill and send it to me, you are putting your name on it and telling me that you think it's not fraud. And if I look at it and believe that it is, that's the first and best way to terminate the relationship. I think secondly, I started my law practice at a law firm where I worked for causes. I was a political and election lawyer. I wanted my clients to win. I would have fought on the street to help them win. And so when my outside counsel don't seem to care how my company does or whether we accomplish our goals, that's another way for me to be quickly shopping for another law firm. And then I think, thirdly, the quality of the advice. I hold my outside lawyers to the same standard I hold my in-house lawyers, which is to say, I want virtually every answer to begin with either yes, explanation, no, explanation, or it depends on blank. And if what you provide me is a word salad, ambiguous blob of gray, then I could have found that on Google myself relatively easily. I'm paying you because you're an expert and you're really good at this particular thing. And if you're not producing quality work, you're pretty quickly going to be dead to me, and I'm sure to anyone here at the table.
So I think in some instances you can't terminate the relationship immediately. But there are usual telltale signs, and I would say, like, when I have corrected outside counsel on certain things and they charge you and bill you for the time that they spent implementing your corrections, that's a no-no.
Yes, I've had that happen as well before.
Yes, that's a no-no. Yeah. But, like, even though in the heat of the moment you would just want to, like, take a knife and slash it, that's not going to happen, right? You have to think about everything from, like, the records, the things that you may need, and things that may need to be completed. But that is the warning shot, and it's things like that that you have to look for. And I totally agree with you, Katie, on, like, you are putting your personal integrity and your professional integrity on the line when you sign that bill and you send it to me and when you provide me advice.
So definitely all of those factors go into whether you stick with counsel or whether you want to make a change. And if it's a billing issue, then I, you know, have spoken to many relationship partners to explain that what they're doing is overkill, because what my team did before I even gave them the issue was thoroughly research it and come out with what we thought the answer was, and the particular question that I wanted solved wasn't give me a 30-page memo from the beginning of time to where we are. No, please just answer the question that we asked you. But if we've asked you the wrong question, I mean, tell us that too. Another, annoying point is when the team doesn't do good work. And like the others on the panel have said, if I could have done this myself, mm-hmm. I would have. And if I look at the work you've done and realize I could do it better, then that's the wrong outside counsel.
Yeah, in fairness, too, I think a lot of in-house lawyers don't know how to partner well with outside counsel. They fail to set expectations at the front of the relationship, and they have a very hard time having difficult conversations. You know, I've started putting my new lawyers through a sort of boot camp when they arrive at the company, because many of them come from associate roles at law firms where they're scared of pushing back at any partner, much less on the question of billing. And so teaching people to have hard conversations and how to set expectations is critical to get the information or the relationship off on the right foot.
I think for the people that I've terminated with outside counsel, I'm always very clear, right? I try to treat you like employees in some respects. You get three strikes with me typically, if they're small strikes. If they're egregious, there's no promise of progressive discipline, right? And it's typically not billing that has rubbed me the wrong way. It's when there's a lack of accountability. Mm-hmm. When there's a screw up, because you will screw up. It's gonna happen. I make mistakes, we all make mistakes. I want you to call me and tell me it happened. I'm not gonna sue you for malpractice, but I want to trust you that you're gonna be able to call me and tell me this went wrong, here's how we're fixing it, I'm writing off the bill, my apologies, it won't happen again. Mm-hmm. And the people that I've terminated, they've not been candid about it, or I found out after the fact, or they've just flat out lied to me and I find out several weeks later, or they weren't transparent. If I can't trust you implicitly because you're acting on behalf of Shamrock and you're acting on my behalf, that's a problem. And it happens more frequently than you would think. And then another very small thing, just lack of responsiveness, complete lack of responsiveness or respect for the fact that I have people, business leaders, that I have to respond to. And they're holding a gun to my head to respond as soon as possible. And so if you don't respond to my email, or if you wait several days, the best thing I love and the people that I use over and over are the people who respond immediately and say, I can't get to this until X. Is that all right? And if that's not all right, I'll go somewhere else or send me to a different person internally. I'm not going to fire you and never come back to you again. But if you wait for 5 days to respond to me, yeah, I'm not going to come back to that source that well again. So in my experience, those are the things that have sort of rubbed me the wrong way with outside counsel. And in fact, one of the people, right when I started at Shamrock, when I day two, somebody came in and said, you need to fire this outside attorney. And I said, why? And they said, he doesn't give a menu. He doesn't give us mild to wild. He gives us mild every time. And so as outside counsel, it's important for you not to give one answer, but say, here's your range. Here's A, B, and C, here's mild to wild. You can decide what you want to do and how aggressive you want to be, but only giving mild because you're too concerned about COAA is not going to work, at least for Shamrock, right? I need to know sort of where we are in the menu.
Yeah, I mean, that's a little, there are two sides to the wild, or I like that, by the way, mild versus
mild.
Wild. There's two sides to that because I often actually don't enjoy working with outside lawyers who just present a range of options and then refuse to say which one they think is best. One of the things I have to do in my job is make a dozen hard choices every single day. And if I can't rely on an outside expert to help me make those choices, if all they're willing to do is type up the options, you know, my more junior lawyers in-house can do that. I'm really hiring expertise and experience and wisdom. And so what I want from my outside lawyers is for them to put their thumb on the scale and say, I think this is the right choice. I'm willing to tell you this is the right thing to do.
One time I had to make the really difficult decision of whether to change counsel in the middle of a major piece of litigation. And it was pretty tough, but it was clear that the team that was on it was not up to the task. And I learned midway through litigation that the associate on the team had made representations to the court that were not run by us. And so that was something that obviously shouldn't have happened and couldn't go on. And what I did was gave the partner an opportunity, one last opportunity, give me a whole new team or you guys are out, which also to me would have meant, and I'll never use you again. But he did present an entirely new team that did a really great job. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm glad I gave them that opportunity. But sometimes, you know, you have to make that hard decision. And while it's hard to change mid-litigation, they had kind of gotten us in a pretty bad spot with the court. And I figured, hey, if there's one way to fix it, it's to get rid of you. And, you know, because it wasn't going to get any better with that particular team.
What about, speaking of teams, what about we've talked about what happens when you need to break up with outside counsel. What do you look for when you're first seeking outside counsel? And what can potential outside counsel do appropriately to market themselves or to kind of put themselves out there as problem solvers and people who can help you with their expertise?
I mean, I think the most important thing is to be honest about what your expertise area is. There are a lot of law firm lawyers who suddenly become experts in whatever the issue du jour is. And one great example of this, Mary Beth and I are very familiar with people who call themselves blockchain lawyers at law firms. And most of them actually are not terribly informed at some of the issues that they're counseling on. I seek out lawyers who are clear experts in their field, and there really is no such thing anymore as one-stop shopping for law firms, thanks to the internet and the fact that myself and my team have great connections all across the country. We can find the very best person for a particular issue. So be honest about what your expertise area is and tell me if you don't think that you're suited for the work. You'll buy my loyalty so much faster that way than by putting together a shoddy work product or reinventing the wheel on my dime.
I always appreciate when outside lawyers flag something for me that maybe I hadn't considered. Because when you're the in-house legal department, there's only three of us lawyers in our legal department and then, you know, half a dozen non-lawyers. I have to think about everything for a huge company. And so when I have outside lawyers who maybe I've met at something like this or some other acquaintance, or even if they cold email me, if they email me and say, hey, I thought about this, I thought about you, I wondered how it would impact Shamrock, have you considered this, you know, is there something that I can do to help you with that? That's helpful for me. That's way more helpful than sort of a mass chain, you know, email or, you know, solicitation that we get. Something where it's like, I thought of you and I thought of Shamrock, does this impact you? Mm-hmm. Have you considered it? That's extremely helpful because that's like having 100 different people out there flagging issues for me.
Have any of you ever found one of those mass emails like industry updates to be helpful, or do you just disregard them?
I almost completely disregard them, but in archival form, they are very useful for law firms. If your law firm has written a really excellent summary of my exact problem, and I find it when I'm initially researching the problem, I will absolutely go hunt down the person who wrote the article. They're rarely useful in the moment you receive them, but archived on your law firm's website, they are very, very useful for business development.
Sometimes I think that the very hot issues of the day, if you recognize that there are a couple of lawyers out there who are writing some very good pieces on these issues, that tells me like this person is really deep in the space. They, mm-hmm. I've read their work. They're logical. They're thoughtful, and that is a lawyer that I'm going to seek out and talk to about a particular issue. It's also important sometimes I think to find a really good quarterback, because not every law firm is right for everything. But sometimes you know it's good to have a good relationship with the lawyer partner in a firm who can say, you know, as the panelists have said, this guy in our firm or gal in our firm really good on this issue and that issue, and so we can help you with this, but no, we're not so much on this. Mm-hmm. And so just really having that awareness to know who in the firm is really good and what things they can handle so that you build this relationship and trust them on those types of issues.
Do you have a sense that a firm's kind of way that it operates can make a difference in how partners might operate in that space? Or do you think it's yes. just a personality thing to do with the partner?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing, just so everyone knows, your compensation system internally is very transparent to your client, because sometimes the client can feel like they're being treated like a piece of meat among two warring partners who each want attribution. You know exactly how a firm is compensating its partners based upon the respect with which they treat you or not. So these kinds of things do matter for how clients perceive you.
Well, and in that regard, you should pass down billing credit and origination credit to the junior attorneys. They'll take better care of us, because that's what happens, right? There's the partner who originates it, and then it gets pushed down to the people down below. Unless you give them billing credit or some sort of vested interest in keeping me happy, they're not going to keep me happy. In fact, recently I fired an entire practice group from a law firm, because the relationship attorney was in a different practice group. They were on different sides of the country. And the practice group that I had ended up with sort of abandoned me, right? I kept getting handed off from person to person, and that's annoying. So there was
I'm sure they billed for the handoff too.
Yeah, of course. And so there was a series of unfortunate events for this particular practice group, but I ended up having to fire them. I liked the relationship attorney, but I can't deal with that. It's probably because none of them were compensated based on my money.
And we sound so mean and bitter up here, but if someone If there's a law firm that has done excellent work for me, I will bring them with me to every job that I go to thereafter. And if you can form that kind of deep relationship with a chief legal officer or a general counsel, you're going to be receiving their business for life. It is not that hard to do this correctly. It's just that a lot of people don't.
Yeah, I have done this. I have brought this one particular partner and firm to different roles. And it is interesting that we are a panel of women GCs, and we do sound like we're pretty tough. And we were never like this when we were in law firms.
But I think we're also, we're respectful of what you all deal with, right? Yeah. So I know when the fiscal year ends for all of my firms, and I make sure that they're completely paid up. So when your partner billing credits and all of your stats are calculated, you're paid in full, even if it's ahead, right? I ask, give me next month's invoice. When is the best time for me to pay this for purposes of your compensation? I always have very transparent conversations because I want you all to benefit from this relationship too.
That's true. I had one of those. It was at the end of the year, and it was a really big bill because it was from the litigation. And the chief operating officer is like, who cares? And I'm like, this is really, really important to this lawyer. It's important to the firm, but it's really important to this lawyer who has given us really good service. And we need to do everything we possibly can to get this thing through. Yeah. And I was their champion in the company and made sure that they got paid.
I see a lot of heads nodding. It sounds like all of you are conscious of helping those who are helping you, making sure that it's a two-way street.
Yeah, you can't stiff somebody or pay them late. Their livelihood depends upon getting their bills paid on time. At the same time, I ask my outside lawyers to be cognizant of the framework within which I have to operate. You know, I work at a startup, which means I'm an equity holder at my company. If you overbill me, it feels like you are reaching into my pocket, taking my wallet out of my pocket, and taking all of my money. So it becomes personal at a certain point.
Jenny, what about you?
Yeah, it's all relationships, right? I think sometimes having been on both sides, you are so focused on the right answer, the right moment, the right service. But at the end of the day, it's how can you actually benefit and help each other to advance things. And I think one of the other things that I value from outside counsel is your intelligence networks, right? The folks you know, the types of information that you have, to make the advice that you give us more robust and much more interesting. And I say that because I sort of live in the tax exempt and political law world where there's one way that the law is actually written and then there's like a whole other way of people who probably actually interpret the advice, particularly the bureaucrats, the lifelong civil servants in the government. And so having that sort of understanding of the environment and not just say, okay, so according to the law, we can't do this, but then there's another, like knowing what the manuals and the administrative procedures, all of that kind of weaves into it. Because at the end of the day, we're all trying to get decisions made, but we're also sort of having to build a story because who knows whenever the government's going to come knocking.
To what extent do you think someone can develop that knowledge by researching and talking to people versus having been on the other side in the government? Do you think both of those are ways to develop that expertise?
Yeah, I think both of those ways are a way to develop. And I also think it's important to understand that all parts of the system, the ecosystem, the government, the academia, the in-house law firms, corporate, like they all coexist together. And I think understanding like what bodies and what things are being said. I just came from a panel where I watched the corporate activism and it was a lot of interesting sort of theoretical insights. But all those things said because government officials all talk to each other, and they all talk to each other overseas too, and they also get bad ideas from overseas too. That's the other issue, and so you always have to be cognizant of all of those things kind of floating in the background, and thinking about a very layered, I worked at the Missile Defense Agency, kind of a layered, right, missile defense approach, almost like the beginning, the middle, and the end, like, and how much time you have to beat back against certain things.
So along those lines, what kind of policies, and we can start with you, would you like to see legislators take up that would make your job easier?
So for legislators and executive branch civil servants, so two, I think, big things is probably understanding culture and understanding the world that we live in. Technology has made things so different. And right here, you know, most of our panels have been talking about cryptocurrency and fintech. I mean, just in that, there's a lot of folks in the government who don't necessarily understand it. For a long time, they were struggling with Uber. I remember working through that. So, and then I think the second thing is, do we really need all the laws that we have? I worked for a very long time on over-criminalization and over-regulation, And we have laws all over this country, federal, state, local, that sometimes we don't know that they exist, but we still have to comply with all of them. And we still have to make sure that we are. And so periodically, kind of like Marie Kondo recommends that you go through things and decide if it doesn't bring you joy anymore, just dump it. I think we probably have to do some of that with our laws too, especially the ones that have been around for a long time and nobody has done anything for a long time. I think former Governor Nathan Deal actually recommended, like, if no one's been prosecuted under something in a federal law, then why do we still have it? Why don't we just kind of chuck it?
I think that's really sage advice. We got dinged on some fish licensing law in the middle of, you know, who knows where, that nobody had any appreciation for. So deregulation is definitely a positive. One thing that would be helpful for anybody, that, or any company that operates in more than one state, is it would be nice to have a national standard for a lot of the employee issues so that we're not playing whack-a-mole with the 50,000 different sick time laws in the United States. Like, if this is the way that we're moving, let's just have one federal standard for sick time and go with it, right? And let's make the bar nice and low for everybody, because for the most part, companies, they want to give benefits. They want to give sick time. And so I don't think you need 100 different places regulating all these different accrual rates. And so it's very difficult to comply with when you operate in multi-jurisdiction. So I think, like FEMLA, for example, that's a nice, easy standard to comply with, the ADA. I think in some states they get a little more aggressive. It's harder to comply with on a national level. So I would like to see some uniform, I'm not saying aggressive, employee regulation and just set it so that we don't have all of these individualized places.
We just went through that exercise globally, coming up with a leave policy for all the countries in which we operate. And the company really wanted to treat everyone fairly. And there was one particular country that the laws in that country would have given them so little that we ended up basically bringing them up to the standards of some of the other countries. And then there were points at which the global CEO said, well, why can't you just make it all the same? Like, we can't, because there are laws in certain countries that give them more than what you want to give them. So at least
you could make it all the same,
right? You can make it all the same. So they pretty much came up, I think, with everyone, and then the one country we had to just give those people a little bit more, you know, to make it even. And I would say, like, regulation generally, in even our, you know, new crypto tech space, like, we want regulation too. We want everyone to be on the same playing field, particularly so that the, you know, U.S. is not always getting the short stick because other countries have, you know, different kind of laws. But they should be reasonable. They should make sense. And whenever the government brings in the industry to try to talk through some of these new pieces of legislation, it usually comes out better because some of the unintended consequences, you know, can be ferreted out of the new legislation. So I always welcome the opportunity, you know, to come in and meet with legislators when they're drafting bills, because that's the time to get in before they pass it, not after.
From a federalism perspective, do you think that one state setting higher standards ends up either benefiting or hurting other states, depending on how you want to define it, by making it easier for the company to treat things on a uniform basis based on whoever set the higher standard? Or is it more worthwhile to try to work out, as you say,
that's a, what it's to a good do. Question. It gets very expensive to do state by state compliance. You do often at a large company find yourself complying with the most onerous regulation, and then all the other states you just see that level of compliance from your company. The issue I think though is more important, kind of going back to your prior question, is just crisp clarity. I mean, Mary Beth and I have both spent lots of time trying to comply with regulations that don't really apply cleanly in the crypto space. And, you know, there is a real chilling effect inside of a business endeavor when it's completely unclear what the law is, especially when the consequences involve orange jumpsuits. I mean, it just paralyzes people, and it really hampers the kind of economic growth that we all want to see, prevents businesses from staying in the United States. And it's a hard thing, the state-by-state compliance question, because, you know, my political views, my, like, deeply held political views would say, well, every state has the right and should, in fact, make its own regulations. But when you're the chief legal officer of a financial services company and you're complying with 50 state regulations and 50 different types of licensing regimes, it becomes expensive very quickly, and it makes it impossible to enter as a new company unless you have millions, literally millions and millions of dollars right off the bat.
I guess in those situations, would it even be potential to have a different law firm in each state, or is that just too extraordinary of an investment?
Yeah, that becomes extraordinarily expensive. There are some really great national law firms that specialize in handing you expensive notebooks of grids to tell you exactly what the law is in every state.
Finders of regulations.
Yeah.
But sometimes we just pick certain states that we just won't operate in. It's just not worth it.
Well, yeah, I mean, New York, for instance, there's a lot of crypto companies that decline to operate in the state of New York because of their BIT license regime. And there are definitely examples of that in other industries as well.
That's interesting. I wonder if states, certainly New York is aware of that, but I wonder if other states may be aware of smaller issues that are keeping companies from engaging in their particular jurisdiction.
I mean, sometimes it's by design.
Right. Well, along that note, in terms of location, how do you manage location issues? I know for you as a privately held company, everything I imagine is centered in Arizona, but if you're looking for new offices or new counsel to deal with particular things, how do you work out the location aspects, and what makes a location more or less favorable for what you're trying to do?
We always look at the regulatory environment. How expensive is it going to be to regulate associates? How easy is it going to be to fire them? Are there changes to the at-will nature of their employment there? What are the recent laws that the legislatures have passed? Who holds all of the different offices? At least for Shamrock, we open in states, or we move towards states that are more culturally similar to us, right? To our existing associate base. And whether our associates, could we transfer our existing base of associates that are in 25 states to that new state, and would they get along just fine, right? We find that we operate the best in states that are culturally similar. So Idaho, we just moved into Idaho in the last couple of years. It was a fantastic addition. We're moving into Montana. So we sort of look at, does it look like us in the mirror?
We're kind of the other extreme. We've become a completely remote company that is headquarterless. And it's been incredible for the company's overall diversity and resilience. Mm-hmm. I couldn't recommend more if your company can withstand the difficulties of dealing with remote work, hiring all across the country. Our team is better for it, our work is better for it, and I think that a lot of shareholder value accrues from it.
Was that inspired by the pandemic, or was that something that your company had already moved to?
It was inspired by the pandemic, but embraced pretty quickly thereafter as more than an accommodation. It really is, I think, just a better way for us to work. And I can't emphasize enough just how our team has been up-leveled as a result of being able to hire everywhere. I mean, I have lawyers in every time zone in the country, people that never would have been able to work for us had they been required to move to San Francisco or New York. And we can move much faster as a result of it. Openings that would have been open for months while we tried to search for somebody who didn't cry when I interviewed them would, now we can fill those spots like that, because there are talented lawyers in every single city in this country, many people who don't want to live in San Francisco or New York, and us being able to hire everywhere has just been incredible, not only for my team, but for really every other team in the company, and improves the diversity of the company on lots of measures.
For us, it's not so much state by state. It's more global, and so we'll look at the employment laws, usually of particular countries. We'll look at the regulation. We'll look at whether we have to have physical presences. What are they going to require? And then we'll decide which countries we want to go into.
Yeah, that is a bigger problem for us than really looking at state regulations, is trying to figure out, is the compliance regime in a particular country worth hiring the two or three people we've identified in that country? You have to reach a tipping point where there's enough hires you want to make in that country before you want to deal with the compliance regimes of those places, especially in financial services, where the regulators are serious and the consequences are serious too.
Does it matter if there's a U.S. legal presence, an international law firm having an office in that country? Is that a relevant part of your consideration or not?
I mean, when I'm looking at international compliance regimes, I definitely gravitate to law firms that have a global footprint, mostly because I can have one relationship partner coordinating all of the research and review for me, and I don't have to engage local law firms in every country. It's just easier.
Sounds like that's pretty consistent amongst all of you. We're getting towards the end of our discussion period. Do any of you have any questions for each other, either generally or specifically that you'd like to pose?
I want to hear why you're making all these people cry, Katie.
Oh, you make people cry too, Mary Beth. You know you do.
I actually only made one person cry in an interview, and it was when I was the United States Attorney. And the person
that makes sense.
You have some weapons at your disposal in that setting.
The person I was interviewing was, I knew her, and I wanted to make it absolutely clear that, you know, just, you know, because I know you, if you work in this office, like, you're going to be the same standard as everyone else. And she also was a little meek. And I had to say, well, look, this is what we do. And sometimes you need to go and you need to tell the district court judge you're wrong. Respectfully, of course. But, you know, can you do that? And she literally, like, sat back in her chair and I thought, did I really, like, go too far with this? She ultimately became a very, very good civil litigator. Now it's your turn to fess up, Katie.
Is this confession hour? I'm sorry, I lost track of it. What are we confessing?
Oh, about the situations in which you've interviewed people
and
the intensity with which you've interviewed.
I like to replicate in an interview what it's going to be like to work at my company. It's a very fast-paced place where you're expected to make decisions very quickly. You're often put on the spot, and things happen, you know, at a faster speed than you're used to. And so sometimes, you know, turning up the pressure in an interview is a really good way to see if somebody's going to be able to withstand 5 days a week of that all day long. And there are some people who are just not. And that doesn't mean that they're bad lawyers. It just means that they're suited for a different environment. And I will frequently say to people I interview, especially if they come out of very legacy institutions such as banks, look, this is a very fast-paced environment. We do things very quickly. We're very action-biased. You're going to be expected to work fast. You're going to have to work through hard problems quickly. And then you're going to have to make a choice. You can't say, well, on the one hand and on the other hand, and you pick. Now, you're going to need to actually take part in the running of the business. And so sometimes being hard in an interview just makes sure that you can weed out the folks who are, you know, going to get blown away by a product manager if they don't get blown away by you.
Sounds like in certain ways you're taking, to give a government model, you're talking to people who've been in the legislative branch. We get to think about it and talk about it and, you know, maybe vote for a bill, maybe not. And the executive branch where you actually have to say, here's what we did today.
Yeah. It's scary to have to sit down and make choices one after the other all day long. You're going to get some of them wrong. And there are folks who I think are more suited and have a better mind for a different context of work.
But I also think that's what makes in-house work so exciting, mm-hmm. is that you have to move at that pace, whoever, you know, your CEO or the business leader is.
Well, I'll ask a few more questions, or at least one more question, to give anyone who has a question from the audience a chance to get up to think about it or to get up to the microphones. So go ahead and get prepared to ask those questions. I know that someone's got something on their mind that you want to hear. What about risk assessment? How do you think through what your risk assessment is when choosing outside counsel or when choosing inside counsel? How do you make a risk assessment about what the right path is in either of those situations?
I mean, this is so fact dependent. You know, the first general counsel that I ever worked for in the tech space taught me some important lessons about strategic risk versus stupid risk. And every risk a company takes must be taken deliberately and not accidentally. That means that you need to approach it with all of the facts and make sure that you have a very reasoned choice and make that choice based upon facts and evidence, as opposed to, you know, stumbling into a bad choice made because you didn't pay attention to the details and you didn't know the law well enough and you didn't actually hear what your client said. So, I mean, the first and most important thing you have to understand is, what is the company trying to accomplish? What is the best way to get there? And what is likely to happen in that preferred approach? And it's hard to say, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, my risk tolerance is 8.5. That's a pretty simpleton way, I think, of looking at the issue. It's very fact dependent, and it depends on how important the goal is and exactly what could happen if it goes wrong.
Great, thank you. It looks like we've got a question. Please feel free to go ahead.
Thank you. David Askin, I'm with in-house at ExxonMobil Corporation. There seems to be a larger and larger disparity between in-house and law firm compensation. And in a lot of in-house law departments, there's certainly been higher attrition in combination with, you know, what's known as the great resignation coming out of COVID. For those companies that just can't match what law firms are willing to pay, I'd like to get your respective thoughts on how do you retain good in-house attorneys, and sort of relatedly, your personal philosophy, not on managing an in-house law department, but on leading an in-house law department. I'd never worked for a law firm except as a summer associate 30 years ago, and I assume it's much different with respect to managing or leading an in-house law department than it is a law firm. So those two issues, and then I have a third question on remote work that I'd like to ask. Thank you.
At least my philosophy is I try to run it like a business person and not a lawyer. If you're in-house, you don't want to work for a law firm. So I try to make it not like a mini law firm, right? So I try to emulate Shamrock as a whole. So the legal department shouldn't operate differently than the rest of it, and my expectations shouldn't be differently. If our business leaders don't expect a response at midnight, I shouldn't expect a response at midnight. I shouldn't expect a phone call. So at least at Shamrock, I try to treat it like you're outside of a law firm. And the companies in Phoenix, or the companies that I have friends at, where the environment is run like, you know, partners at the top and associates at the bottom, yeah, they do churn through lawyers because you're not treating it like what it is, which is a business as opposed to a law firm. So at least that's how I've managed to retain it. And I think, again, ours is small enough that's a little different than a 30-person in-house department. But culturally, you got to be able to build those bonds and have really transparent conversations. So I regularly have conversations with everybody in the legal department once a week. How you doing? How's it going? I think lawyers sometimes lose sight of the fact that building good associate relations is so critical to keeping and retaining people, and also giving them a variety of benefits. You can give them more than just compensation. So one of the things that we do at Shamrock is you have discretionary time off, which is like law firms. At law firms, you don't get PTO. You come and go and you do your hours and you bill, right? There's no like time off. So I think the more that you can treat lawyers like they were in law firms in the sense of the benefits, right? They can come and go when they please. You can take as much vacation as you want at Shamrock. I don't care if you're out for months on end. As long as you get your work done and you're responsive, it doesn't really matter. So I think there are other things that you can give people besides sort of their base comp to keep and retain them.
For lawyers who are only interested in the salary, you're never going to be able to retain them because you're not going to get that, in-house. It's the lawyers who, as I think the panel's been saying, who really want to take part in the business and who want to understand how the company works and to be able to help different components are the ones that will really enjoy the in-house job. There's also some lawyers that just hated, business development and weren't good at it. And those people like, you know, being in-house because they get to be lawyers and help solve problems. It just depends on the person. There's a lot of different qualities that you look for and different kinds of people who enjoy different things.
You know, on the compensation question, I think the tech space is a little bit different than other in-house roles because the cash comp is never going to match a law firm, but the equity compensation can be life-changing if the company succeeds. So you have to look for lawyers who are willing to take a little bit of a risk and who believe in the company's mission. And it's relatively easy to find smart people who are willing to do that, I think. As to leadership, I have just a few leadership principles, and they include hiring people smarter than I am, inspiring them and helping them set goals, and then getting out of their way. You can't retain brilliant people if you muck around in how they do their work. And so part of what I do is try to sit on my hands as much as possible and then just clear hurdles for people when they encounter them inside the company.
Jenny, any perspective from you on the comp issue?
I guess my question for you on this is like, were they surprises and why were they complete surprises? And did the exit surveys give you any additional data points?
There were surprises. There were surprises. And the veracity of some of the exit interviews, you know, in order to maintain relationships and all, it's difficult to trust what they told us.
One question I have, I think I've noticed in my experience and that of law firm lawyers, I know the very worst part of being a law firm lawyer is generally considered to be keeping your time. Is that something that you're able to forego at your companies, or do you still need people to keep track of their time?
I don't even know where people are most of the time, much less exactly what they're working on. If you come work at any in-house company, you will not have to write your time down. So apply to any of us.
Before I started the government, the night before, I literally had a nightmare that on my first day, they told me I was going to still have to keep my time. So I think that is a very deep concern of a lot of law firm lawyers.
One just follow-up. On remote work, and this isn't just specific to in-house counsel, but HR departments have identified the issues. It makes it very difficult to do mentoring. It makes it very difficult to do career development. And then the connection between the individual and the company is easily frayed or separated. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple of months ago, and it talked about hoteling at companies where employees don't have a designated office space. And having a designated office space where you could have your photographs of your cat up and other things like that made a big difference in connecting those individuals to their friends at the company. And of course, Zoom happy hours don't do that. So how do you manage the remote work and those particular HR and attrition issues?
I think this is a company cultural question. You know, like I said, my company has embraced remote work, and we found it to be a great way to retain people, not a way to drive them away faster. And I think you do have to be very deliberate about how you establish ties with your coworkers and how you mentor. All of these things are possible, and they can be done really well, but you can't just take in-person practices and import them to Zoom. You have to do what the internet is good at natively doing. And so our company has put a lot of thought into how can you bring the company into this new way of working? And you know, we've certainly found that being able to, giving a lawyer an amazing job at a San Francisco tech company and they can live wherever they want in the world is something that will keep most people around.
I think you still have to have team events in person and plan them, because there's nothing that takes the place of being able to spend a few days with people.
That's
and
right.
So you have to really plan that and find ways for the team to get together from time to time. But I think it probably still comes out to be a lot cheaper than maintaining all of those separate offices.
Mm-hmm. Next question.
Hi, everyone. Does this work? Yes, it sort of does. Okay. Hi, I'm Ari Spitzer. I'm currently a 2L in law school, so still very much thinking about where my career could take me, and this has been a very, very helpful and interesting panel. I'm curious, in all of your positions in-house, when you are thinking about hiring people from large law firms to come over in-house, what kinds of experiences or specializations are you looking for when you make that decision? What type of candidate would be right for that specific opportunity? I have to guess that the answer is going to be different based on the different types of companies that you work for, but to the extent that there are any commonalities between your answers, that would be very helpful for me and the other students in this room that are thinking about what the next stages in our careers are. Thank you.
I think it depends on the size of your in-house department. At least with us, there's only three of us. So we're air traffic control, right? We don't retain any legal work in-house for the most part. There are some things that we do in-house, but everything is pushed out. So when you're air traffic control, I need issue spotters. I need well-rounded people who have really good interpersonal skills, can engage with the business and say, hey, that's an orange jumpsuit problem. We need to run that up the flagpole, right? I need people who are litigators. I need people who are contract lawyers. In fact, one of our attorneys that we hired, he doesn't know employment law, but I'm training him to be an employment lawyer because he did transactional work, he litigated, so he's really well-rounded, and he can fly a jet, and we have a jet, so like he's our third pilot, right? So it was like a twofer, right? I got a lawyer pilot twofer. So, you know, it just kind of depends. I told you, we're looking for well-rounded, at least at Shamrock.
Practical people. Yes. That's what we need.
Yeah, I mean, at a bigger law department, you'll need to specialize just like you need to in a law firm. You know, inside of a company, you can be a corporate lawyer or a litigator or a product counsel, a very specific tech company thing. There are a lot of different things you can do. And certainly, I think when I'm hiring for those more specialized roles, I'm looking for people who've done something roughly equivalent at their law firm.
I think to Carrie's point, though, I think what's underlying is the soft skill development is going to be key. The specializations, it's sort of kind of the luck of the draw, depending on the job description. And the knowledge piece is key, too. But I think the entire legal profession, all the businesses that we know of as today may not exist a couple years from now or even 10 years from now. And so I think it's thinking about like how to be effective at learning, unlearning, and relearning.
Great advice. Thank you all. Next question.
Yes, thank you. Allison Hayward. I work at the Facebook Oversight Board. I am not in their counsel's office. And I don't fly a jet. An experience I had back when I was a real lawyer that I kind of want to anonymize, but I'll also get your reaction to, involved an outside counsel that I was working with that was doing good work but had done something else that made them notorious in the public eye. And we had problems with other people in the organization feeling that this person was an inappropriate, this group of people were inappropriate to work with, even though they were doing good work. Have you had that experience? How did you handle it?
I have not had that experience, but that's a tough one. I feel like Carrie can answer that question.
Yeah, since you have the jet.
Right.
Yeah, the pilot.
So I guess I just want to make sure I totally understand it. There's someone on the outside, an outside counsel had done something wrong, and then the business people didn't really want to work with them because of it.
Wrong in the eyes of business people. They'd done something controversial.
I see. Okay. Well,
you know, I was operating in a political nonprofit sphere, and so you know, you have people above you who are sensitive
sure.
to optics in a way that business people may not be.
And to make everyone more comfortable, we'll assume that you're operating in a hypothetical about if this happened rather than it has happened.
Well, at least at Shamrock, we're privately held, right? So there's only one shareholder that really matters. And so if he's not happy with it, that's it, right? My hands are tied. If it's somebody else, then I can be a little bit more persuasive. It hasn't happened yet, thank God, but interesting. So in my instance, it would really just depend on pissing off one person.
I've hypothetically not had this situation, but it comes up a lot, right? Because people, I think the question is like, do we have personal lives anymore? I think becomes the big question in a lot of this. And so you have to, and this goes back to like a judgment thing too, and knowing like if who you're serving and who your kind of audience base is from a client perspective, your outside counsel, be upfront with your in-house counsel about certain things so that like they know about it and they can make an educated decision with the business people, because no matter how great your work product is, sometimes if the mores or whatever of that era become problematic, it can be problematic. But again, it all depends on the facts of what exactly that perceived like wrong personal activity is.
Yeah, I think the question is looking at what did the person do, exactly what this is the facts and circumstances, and does that action of that person put the company in jeopardy in any way? And if the answer is yes, then you got to get rid of the person, because you have to always maximize the value and the reputation of the company and ask and answer that question.
Is the answer to the question, does it hurt the company, sometimes different than the answer, should it hurt the company?
I would say no. I think the answer to the shareholders has to be, does it hurt the company?
I think it depends on whether you're publicly held or privately held.
Yeah, true.
Great. All right, thank you. Next question.
Hi, everyone. My name is John Reeves. I'm a solo appellate practitioner in St. Louis, Missouri. My question for everyone, just as a general matter, obviously as in-house counsel, you're responsible, among other things, for hiring and retaining outside counsel for your litigation. Carrie, it's funny, you said you're like air traffic control. I actually heard that comparison made about a month ago, and it finally hit me. You know, like, that's the difference. You know, we're outside counsel, we're the pilots. You're all the focusing on one thing. You're the air traffic controllers focusing on the big picture. My question is, how common has it become for any of you to, in retaining outside counsel for litigation, to retain appellate specialists on appeal, to handle your appeals that may be different from trial counsel, and or as part of that, if like a case goes to trial, to have like an appellate specialist or a group of appellate specialists embedded at trial? Because I ask that because that's something that seems to have become more common in the last few decades. Thank you.
I found that good trial lawyers are not good writers sometimes. And so oftentimes I have the trial team, and then I have the shadow lawyers behind them actually doing the work for them, right? Doing the writing, doing the legal research, doing the motions for summary judgment. because there's usually a disconnect. And then the same is true with appellate lawyers, right? When I was in private practice, I did appeals. I know there is a difference between a trial lawyer and an appellate lawyer. So if it was a big important piece of litigation, yeah, I have separate teams of people do everything. And sometimes they're at different law firms, right?
Yeah.
I think it's better to have multiple law firms so you have multiple perspectives on things. And at least in my position, I'm able to save money elsewhere that I can spend a lot when it matters, right? I can spend a lot and I can hire specialists. And how much your hourly rate doesn't really matter, right? Because I'm sort of looking at the legal budget as a whole. And I don't mean to speed on that, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So I often have different groups of people. But if it's like a generic run-of-the-mill employment case in California that we've won and now we're going to the Ninth Circuit, I'll probably just keep the same trial lawyers to do the appeal.
Anybody else have feedback on that question?
I think it depends on whether the trial team lost the case or not. if that happens, then generally it is another firm that'll come in and handle the appeal.
Okay.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, next question.
Hi, I'm Maggie Beecher. I'm at Napa Legal here in DC. My question is about communication. Obviously, one of the most exciting parts of being in-house is taking complicated legal issues and explaining them in a way the business side will engage with and maybe even enjoy. Obviously, all four of you have that skill. I can tell just listening to you. How have you cultivated that ability to translate?
Keep it very short, very simple, and I don't put it in an email, right? If I send an email that's longer than three sentences, nobody's going to read it.
No one's going to read it.
Right? So I always, if I get an email, I schedule a meeting, I talk to them, and I'm like, here's your choices, 1, 2, and 3, mild to wild, right? Like, it's pretty simple.
It's a little bit different for me, and I suspect Mary Beth, too. I mean, folks in the tech industry tend to have a much higher tolerance for deep, dense legal analysis. Engineering-focused leaders very much want to understand why, and they want to pick apart your analysis in ways, frankly, that make you a much better lawyer. So what I've learned is how to communicate very rigorously and anticipate the questions that are going to be asked about that communication and to speak by analogy as much as possible to help people understand.
I think it all started in the courtroom. And when you think about what you do as a trial lawyer, you take complicated legal and sometimes complicated factual issues and you boil it down so that a group of people, regardless of their education level or life experiences, can understand and that you're just basically having a conversation with a group of people.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Thanks for your question. Do we have one more headed over? Great.
Yes. My name is Ryan Haney. I'm in-house counsel at the Oklahoma Council of Public Affairs. My question is, what is the appropriate balance between trusting outside counsel to make decisions when you have a background as well and you think that you should go one way, outside counsel thinks you should go another way, aside from the fact that there are professional responsibility issues there? What's that appropriate balance, especially if outside counsel treats in-house counsel like they're not real lawyers?
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, I've never outsourced a single decision to an outside counsel, period, stop. I'm paid for my business context and my knowledge of the company's goals. My outside lawyers are there to advise me and provide feedback, but they do not make decisions for me. I would be committing malpractice if I allowed that to happen.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, the outside counsel, even though they may be specialists in certain areas, they are advising. And then even the in-house counsel, we take that advice from outside counsel and then we advise, you know, the head of the company to make the decision. And also remember that law firms are very risk adverse. And so they have general counsels, you know, who are having them take the most, you know, narrow conservative answer. And sometimes that is not the approach that the business side decides to go with. And so totally agree with Katie. It's the general counsel has to take all the information that they're getting and then make the best advice to the client based on all this information.
But if I'm in an area where I'm completely unfamiliar, perhaps, and it just is bizarre, the advice I got doesn't make sense. I can't relay that in a coherent way to the business person, nor will that be a good result based on what their business objectives are. I just call a different lawyer, right? I'll pay for somebody else to research the same exact issue and see where they are, see what their view of it is. Because sometimes the outside lawyer is just wrong, right? Or they're just off base, and I've had that happen recently. So you have to know enough in-house, even in areas where you're out of your wheelhouse, to think, this doesn't feel right. This is not what the law should be.
You know, and to address something else you said, what do you do when outside counsel treat you like you're not a real lawyer? So I would not work with anyone who didn't treat me like a real lawyer, as I've probably established already. But I would urge those outside lawyers to get with the times. You know, I think maybe 30, 40 years ago, in-house law practice was considered the backwater, but it is now one of the hottest places to be as a lawyer. There, if you can find the right gigs, they are very hard to get. They are very well compensated, and they are very interesting. So that in-house lawyer you're talking to probably has a pretty sweet job, and looking down on them, you do at your peril.
Well, looking down on anyone, you do at your peril.
That's also fair.
Yes. Yeah.
That is great advice to end on, I would say. Thank you all for being a great engaged room, and thank you most of all to our wonderful panelists for sharing such great information tonight.